Hi, this is NPR's On Health. I'm Joe Neal.
I'm Brenda Wilson, and today we're going to talk about willpower, the fact that some of us don't have very much of it. In fact, some of us have the willpower of marshmallows.
Then we're going to look at the willpower of marathon runners to keep going even as they get older and start having problems.
And then we're going to talk about good fat, or brown fat, actually.
Brown fat, that's different than white fat?
Yes, you can't see it, really.
And finally, we'll talk about the AIDS epidemic in the U.S. now and what it was like 25 years ago.
That's right.
In our first story, NPR's Elise Spiegel looks at how you can train yourself to have more willpower, and she takes a look back at some old experiments from the 60s where children were teased with marshmallows to see if they could develop willpower. Let's hear it.
Mike Harmon couldn't explain what had happened to his willpower. 15 years ago, he told me, his willpower was something that he could count on, something he could use, for example, to quit smoking. But then his girlfriend left, and when she left, he says, his willpower seemed to leave with her.
Willpower. I don't have it anymore.
What happened to your willpower?
I don't know. Couldn't tell you.
I met Harmon at the Baltimore County Stop Smoking Hypnosis Clinic a couple weeks ago. He was there with 16 other people who also seemed to have misplaced their willpower. That's why they were at the clinic at 9 on a Thursday night for a session of group hypnosis. They all felt they had the motivation, but their willpower had somehow malfunctioned. People like Niecy Riley, a woman in her 40s who sat next to Harmon.
You know, I'm seeking help because I need something beyond me. My willpower is not doing it. I can't do it on my own.
Riley went on to explain that willpower comes from within. She couldn't say where within exactly. Was it the head? Was it the heart? But a woman near her, Velma Dunn, was pretty clear on this point.
Your soul, the pit of your stomach, you know, the deepest depths of within your body.
Willpower is a very familiar word. But what is it really? What actually happens in the mind when you resist your impulses in the face of temptation?
If you think about willpower, you can break it down into two processes.
This is Professor Walter Michel, a psychologist at Columbia University. Michel has a long history with willpower. In fact, he was one of the first people to look at the process of willpower in detail. Back in the 60s, Michel did a series of studies, now popularly known as the marshmallow tests. He took 4-year-old kids, one by one, put them in a room with a marshmallow or cookie on the table in front of them, then explained that they could either eat the treat immediately, or, if they could wait until he got back, have to instead. Now, some of these kids could hardly wait a minute. Others lasted as long as 20. And Michel believes that you can learn most of what you need to know about the actual process of exerting willpower from the strategies employed by these children. There are two basic strategies, he says, and the first is not very complicated.
Distract yourself, you know, play with your toes or get involved in singing a song or play with something else.
Minus the playing with toes, this same method is used by adults who resist impulses. They simply shift their attention when temptation crops up. Now, the second strategy, says Michel, is more complicated. It involves actively changing the way you think about the object of desire.
Now, the natural, the normal, the pre-wired way in which a 4-year-old will be thinking about those marshmallows, if she lets herself think about them, is how yummy and chewy they're going to taste.
The same can be said of a smoker or an alcoholic. They'll focus on the immediate pleasure of an experience. We'll think of the temptation, Michel likes to say, in a hot or emotional way. And that makes it harder to resist. But if you do want to resist, says Michel, what you need to do is think about the object you desire in a cold, cognitive way. So, for example, to help the children resist the treat, before leaving the room, Michel told the kids to imagine the treat in front of them differently.
Think about those marshmallows as if they're just cotton puffs or clouds. That instruction with the 4-year-old has a dramatic effect on her ability to wait for the thing that she couldn't wait for before.
And the dynamic is identical for adults. By refocusing thinking on, say, long-term consequences, it's easier to resist an impulse. Of course, actually using these strategies is one of those things easier said than done, which is why the Baltimore County Hypnosis Clinic is in no immediate danger of going out of business. Elise Spiegel, NPR News, Washington.
But there are people with a lot of willpower, and in our next story, we're going to look at people who compete in marathons, have a lot of athletic talent as well. But one longtime competitor says the greatest test of willpower comes when you have to give up that competition, which you love so much. NPR's Allison Aubrey has the story for us.
If you've managed to finish 47 marathons in your life, as retired Navy Captain Howard Studley has, it goes without saying that running is a passion and a big part of your identity. That is, until it becomes part of your past, memorialized with photos and a commemorative medal or two. Studley has displayed his alongside his flight pilot accolades.
Yeah, it's, I love me wall.
The love you all.
The love you all.
Bragging about all your accomplishments in life.
Well, some of them, yeah. That was Boston 79.
The year he finished the Boston Marathon in 3 hours and 12 minutes. Studley says he didn't have any special talent as a runner. Running was more of a habit he couldn't break. In the 1979 photo, he's running with a good friend.
This is me right here. Did 47 marathons, 105 triathlons, and many, many other races. I used to be a pretty dedicated runner till my knees gave out.
Howard Studley is 73 now, and he says as much as he loved it, he probably should have stopped long-distance running sooner. But he says as an active-duty military pilot, his running shoes were his easy companion.
I ran in the snow in Adak, Alaska, and the ice in Iceland, and the heat in Spain, and took no days off.
Sports medicine doc and orthopedic surgeon Dan Peerless says many of his patients sound a lot like Studley.
I think sometimes people who are exercise fanatics or who do a lot of running, they become, quote unquote, the runner. That's their identity, and it's very difficult if somebody has to give that up.
They can't imagine any other satisfying way to stay fit. Peerless says he empathizes, especially now as he himself, a long-distance runner, is nursing a serious ankle injury. As we talk, he has one leg elevated in a walker on wheels. It's not what he expected at 47.
It's very hard. And people say, well, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? And you really have to adapt. You have to look at the long range, and it's a matter of transition.
Which can be tough, because with the transition comes the acceptance that you may have to alter your expectations and acknowledge your limits.
Myself, I just had this operation about a month ago, and so it is difficult. And you really do have to force yourself into a routine.
And that takes willpower. Peerless says his new routine, once he recovers, will likely include more swimming and biking, which aren't hard on the joints. He says with his patients, a big part of getting them over the hump is to help them design new exercise routines.
In fact, I'll sit with people and I will make it part of the visit to establish a habit. When can we squeeze it in?
Those who are successful in establishing new habits, Peerless says, tend to view their workouts as appointments that can't be broken, something that most runners already have a leg up on. Over the decades, Howard Studley says he's always tried to keep his appointments.
As I've gotten older, I tend to wake up real early. I woke up at 3:30 this morning, but the first thing I did was about 40 minutes of exercise. And so I do that every day. I don't miss a day.
His routine is definitely not as rigorous as it once was. And Studley says sometimes in his sleep, he still dreams that he's running.
You got to play the cards you're dealt. So if you can't run, then you walk. I walk almost every day.
But lately, as he prepares for neck surgery, he's focused on gentle stretching and some resistance work with a band. Surgeon Dan Peerless says people like Studley are doing the right things. He says what's telling about long-distance running is when you look at marathon entry forms, the ages of competitors are very predictable.
There's a ton of folks in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, and all of a sudden in the 50s, it precipitously drops. 60s, almost nobody. And there's a reason.
The long-distance pounding, he says, takes its toll. And scaling it back when you're used to pushing the limits, or even making a habit out of a new kind of exercise, can be tough tests of willpower as well. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
And when you have to give up competition, that means you might start putting on some weight. And our next story, we're going to hear about a new thing called brown fat. I haven't heard about this before. Do you, Brenda?
No, but it's actually not bad, this brown fat. It's the kind that you don't have to burn off with exercise.
It actually raises your body temperature and helps you burn off the bad fat.
Yes.
That's the way I understand it.
So you might want to keep those thermostats low so that you'll kind of rev up more for your brown fat, shall we say. Dick Knox is going to explain it all to us.
Brown fat looks different from the yellowish-white stuff we think of when we hear the word fat. That's because it's packed with little energy factories that give it a dark color. For decades, scientists have been fascinated by the unique properties of brown fat.
This is probably the only tissue whose purpose is to burn energy. in other words, just to produce heat.
That's Francesco Celi of the National Institutes of Health. Like other scientists, he used to think that brown fat was only important to human infants. They can't shiver or move around much, so they need brown fat to keep warm. But everybody thought that people lose brown fat as they grow up. The new studies show without doubt that adults have it too. This is good news, because brown fat, like good cholesterol, is healthy stuff, says Aaron Cypress of Joslin Diabetes Center in Boston.
We call brown fat good fat because, as far as we know, it does only good things. It is able to take excess calories within the body and burn them up, therefore able to reduce obesity.
Cypress and his colleagues examined nearly 2,000 high-tech scans, which highlight tissue that's metabolically active. They found deposits of brown fat in almost everybody. Older people have less, so do obese people, but virtually everybody has some. Meanwhile, other teams were also finding brown fat in adults. A group at the University of Maastricht in Holland decided to do scans on a couple dozen people after putting them in a chilly room for a couple of hours. They figured that low temperature, about 61 degrees, would activate the brown fat just as it does in babies, so it would start producing heat.
And indeed, that worked. We were very surprised to see that much brown fat as we did, and in so many people as we did.
That's Wouter van Marken-Lichtenbelt, who led the team. He wonders if people trying to lose weight might find it easier if they just turn down the thermostat.
Yes, turning down the heater in the house, and then you start heating yourself.
With your own activated brown fat. There may be something to that. A Scandinavian team reports that putting research subjects in a chilly room for a couple of hours revved up the calorie-burning capacity of their brown fat cells 15-fold. Cypress, the Boston researcher, thinks turning down the heat deserves a closer look as a diet strategy.
What we need to find out is, how many more calories do you burn off if you sit at a home at 60 degrees Fahrenheit versus 72 versus 80? And if, in fact, it looks like you're burning off way more calories, then that might be a very simple way to lose weight and help your health.
But what if people compensated for being chilly by eating more? That possibility has Cypress and others looking to drugs as a way to rev up those brown fat cells. It might not take much.
We calculate that if you had 3 ounces worth, that would be enough to burn up 400 to 500 calories per day.
Wow.
Yeah.
Clearly, those brown fat cells are powerhouses at burning calories. All three research papers appear in this week's New England Journal of Medicine. Richard Knox, NPR News, Boston.
So word, Joe. Be cool. Chill. It may, you know, help your metabolism a bit.
No, it's certainly cold enough in this studio. Maybe I should just sit here all day and that's how I'll lose weight.
Well, you know, I'm okay. I've got a lot of brown fat.
All right. Well, let's move on to our last story, which is not humorous. It's about the AIDS epidemic in the U.S. And last year, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention researchers came up with a new estimate of HIV in the U.S., and it turns out that there are quite a few more infections than they thought. I think the number is now 56,000 a year.
Yes, and it used to be 40,000. They figured it had stabilized at 40,000, and it turns out if it's stabilized, and it's not clear that it has, it's actually higher than they thought.
Why is it there's so many more?
Partially, they weren't counting everybody. They're now pushing states to routinely test people in a lot of different medical settings so that they will have a better idea of who or how many people in this country are infected with HIV.
So when you go into the hospital, you'll just automatically get an HIV test instead of going through a whole procedure?
Some states are doing that better than other states. Actually, the District of Columbia, which has probably one of the worst epidemics in the country, has a really good record now. They've doubled the number of people who have been tested in the city.
You went over to the White House yesterday, Brenda, to a meeting where there's some new effort to get the prevention message out?
Yes. The administration of President Obama has now sort of, I guess, taken its first step, what it's calling its first phase, and refocusing the attention of people in this country on the epidemic that we have here. The previous administration focused a lot more on the global HIV/AIDS epidemic, but this White House has decided that particularly because we have such a difficult and serious epidemic among African Americans. That's where they're going to start. More than half of the people who are becoming infected now, new infections, are among African Americans. So they invited individuals from about 14 different organizations to come to the White House and unveiled a new media campaign for TV, radio, and online, giving the message to Americans that every 9.5 minutes, somewhere, someone becomes infected with HIV in the United States.
Wow, 9.5 minutes. That's pretty startling.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's kind of hard to believe.
Well, we were looking through our archives and discovered that 25 years ago this year, was the discovery of the AIDS virus itself. It was announced first in France and then in the U.S., and there was a lot of debate over it. But we thought it would be interesting to take a listen to the story as it was presented then, just to give you some perspective on AIDS now versus AIDS back then. Daniel Zwerdling did the piece for us, and it's introduced by former NPR host Bob Edwards.
Reagan administration officials and scientists from the National Institutes of Health have made official what the news media has been speculating for several weeks. At a news conference here in Washington yesterday, it was announced that a team of American scientific researchers believe they found the virus that causes AIDS, the deadly disease that's afflicted more than 4,000 people and killed almost 2,000. NPR's Daniel Zwerdling reports.
The leader of the research team, Robert Gallo, calls the virus HTLV-3. He says it's closely related to another virus that causes cancer, but the new one acts differently. Instead of invading the body's white blood cells and making them go haywire and multiply and cause cancer, the HTLV virus kills the white blood cells, and that destroys the body's ability to fight off diseases. Here, Gallo said, is the key evidence that he's found the AIDS culprit.
Approximately 90% of people with AIDS have detectable antibodies in their serum that react specifically with this particular virus. Patients with pre-AIDS, it's about 80%. And normal heterosexuals, healthy heterosexuals, it's less than a half, it's less than 1%.
Gallo said he and his colleagues have developed a blood test which can tell who has AIDS and who doesn't. Researchers said that will help them understand how the disease gets started and progresses. And Gallo said he's also developed a way to mass produce the virus in the laboratory, and that researchers predict will enable them to produce a vaccine against AIDS in the next 2 to 3 years. Although Edward Brandt, Assistant Secretary of Health and Human Services, said he would caution people who have AIDS right now not to get their hopes up.
This discovery may not be of direct benefit to them in the immediate future, but it opens up for the first time, I think, the real possibility that we may be able to develop an intervention system that we haven't so far.
Gallo and his colleagues may feel confident that they've found the cause of AIDS, but other scientists say it might be too soon to celebrate. Malcolm Martin, director of the Molecular Microbiology Laboratory at the National Institutes of Health, says the researchers need to do more than show that AIDS victims are infected with the suspect virus. He says they need to show that the virus actually causes AIDS.
I'm not sure anybody actually has the causative agent of AIDS. One would like to be able to cause the disease, and one can't cause such a disease in man. It's just unethical to take the agent, obviously, and put it into people. The next step might be to find a suitable animal test system to produce a disease like AIDS and really demonstrate unequivocally that it comes down, and that could be difficult to do.
Second, even if the researchers have found the virus that causes AIDS, scientists disagree about how long it will probably take to develop a vaccine that can prevent it. For instance, French researchers at the Pasteur Institute in Paris have also been studying AIDS, and Luc Montagnier, director of the research team, told me he doubts a vaccine can be ready in less than 5 years. He said it could take as long as a decade. When you consider those reservations, the fanfare which surrounded yesterday's announcement suggests that the AIDS problem has become more than a scientific issue. It's become a political one. The main speakers at yesterday's press conference, for instance, weren't the scientists who actually worked on the AIDS project. They were two Reagan administration officials, including the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Margaret Heckler. Heckler noted that in the past, critics have disparaged the administration's commitment to AIDS research. Critics, she said, have said we weren't doing enough. But Heckler said the new discovery shows they're wrong.
But yeah, arrow of funds, medical expertise, research and experimentation, which the Department of Health and Human Services and its allies around the world have aimed and fired at the disease AIDS, has hit the target.
By leaping into the public spotlight now, the Americans also seem to be playing a delicate game of international scientific one-upsmanship. See, the French researchers at the Pasteur Institute have also found a virus that they believe probably causes AIDS. And both the French and Robert Gallo say they think they've all identified the same virus. They're mailing each other samples this week to make sure. The side that gets final credit for finding the AIDS virus first could win the cherished Nobel Prize and a place in scientific history. I'm Daniel Zwerdling in Washington.
And it turns out we still don't have a vaccine against HIV.
And there's still not much of a prospect of one either.
No. Montagnier, however, in last year, as a matter of fact, mm-hmm. was awarded the Nobel Prize for the discovery of the virus, along with his partner at the Pasteur Institute.
Well, that's it for this edition of NPR on Health. We hope you enjoy the podcast. If you want to tell us more of what you want or what you don't want, write us at nprhealth@npr.org. I'm Joe Neal. Thanks for listening.
I'm Brenda Wilson, and remember to keep those thermostats low.
We will.
Okay.
Thank you.